Hello, welcome to My Camino, the podcast. I'm Dan Mullins, and it's great to have your company. I'll just start this week by saying thank you to Julie, who joined me as a Patreon sponsor this week. I really appreciate it, Julie, and you can sponsor me too by going to patreon.com/Dan Mullins and help to keep the Camino podcast alive. This is a podcast about El Camino de Santiago, or the Way of St. James. James was one of Christ's apostles, a humble fisherman who went on to be a disciple. The Camino is a pilgrimage walked by pilgrims. Once you step onto the path, you begin a unique journey. It may be that your journey begins at your front door, or your journey begins the moment you decided you were going to undertake the Camino. For me, it was stepping out of my front door in 2016 to walk the Camino to mark my 50th birthday. Most pilgrims head to the Spanish city of Santiago de Compostela, St. James under a field of stars, where St. James's remains are interred in a crypt beneath the city's cathedral. I walked into Santiago de Compostela on my 50th birthday. It was a coming of age in a number of ways. I'd discovered, in the Camino, something I truly loved, a freedom I'd never found before, a place I felt truly alive and awake. And you just have a really good time with really good people. It's as simple as that. Pilgrims from all around the world, and you'll find yourself making friends from all four corners of the globe. And letting the long Spanish afternoon slip by as the sun makes its way to the horizon is one of the true joys in the world. You might wander the streets of the town you're staying in that night, perhaps collect a stamp or two for your credential. You might attend Mass. You might find a small museum or a local library. You might simply find a quiet spot to catch up on some valuable sleep taken from you the night before by a nearby snorer. Or you might spend the afternoon in one of the bars or cafes along the Camino, where you'll find people you've walked with the hours, days or weeks before, making friends, listening and sharing stories, lessons, and learning a thing or two about life. You'll enjoy pinchos, small selections of food served with your drinks. Or maybe you're like me and love your café con leche. Spain is magic. Walking in France is something like walking through the pages of a Tolkien novel. You can't believe the views, the vistas, the endless horizons spanning out before you as you make your way west, one step at a time. Anthony Bourdain said of Spain in his off-the-cuff TV series, "Any reasonable sentient person who looks at Spain, comes to Spain, eats in Spain, drinks in Spain, they're going to fall in love. Otherwise, there's something deeply wrong with you." I couldn't agree more. My guest this week is a Canadian pilgrim who clearly has developed a long and deep love affair with Spain and the Camino. His name is Brad Batten. He's on the line from Kingston, Ontario. Welcome, pilgrim.
Thank you, pilgrim. It's good to be here. What can I say after that wonderful opening you gave? I mean, I think you just covered it all. Goodbye. I mean, that was sweet. That really captures it. Really, I appreciate being here, and I appreciate the work you do, and you know, like the work that like Lee does at the Camino Cafe. All we're just walking along, and it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Yeah. There's an old saying: we're all just walking one another home.
Yeah.
Now, as I said there in the intro, you're from Kingston, Ontario, home to the iconic Canadian band, The Tragically Hip. Now, The Tragically Hip and me is a love affair, and it's because of the Camino, right? So I met three Canadian pilgrims on the Camino in 2016, Miles, Kevin, and Dougie. And subsequently, we kept in touch. In fact, I lost them. I couldn't find them on my final day. I came back to Australia. I didn't have their names, their numbers. I didn't have anything. I just had their first names. And I posted on Facebook, "Hey, does anyone know these three Canadian guys who were on the Camino?" And I found them within 24 hours. But it was Miles who wrote to me like a year later, and he just sent me a clipping. It was the lead singer of the band, Tragically Hip, Gord Downey, being honoured by the Canadian Assembly of First Nations. And the video shows him crying, and the First Nations elder was placing a feather in his hat. And they're crying, and I'm thinking, I'm watching it, who is this guy? Why has Miles sent me this guy? There's a guy in a suit in the background. He's crying too. That's, I realise, Justin Trudeau, the Canadian Prime Minister. So in this moment, I'm introduced to Gord Downey, and the band The Tragically Hip, and his work via The Secret Path, the story of a 12-year-old Ojibwe boy, Chaney Wenjack, who died from hunger and exposure trying to escape from a residential school where First Nations children were stolen from their families. It's just a wonderful, wonderful journey. He died good, yeah. died from a brain tumor in 2017, and then, you wouldn't believe it, Brad, I discover Sarah Harmer, Blue Rodeo, Jim Cuddy, Catherine McClellan. Right? So I discover
So you just found them in 2016.
Okay. So all of a sudden I just love this Canadian music scene. So when I saw that you were from Kingston, Ontario, I was like, wow, that's amazing. So there's my Canadian music lesson to start our chat this morning. So
you know Leonard Cohen and Joni Mitchell.
Yeah, of course. And Neil Young and of course Katie Lang.
Bruce Coburn.
I just love it. But let's start with a very simple question. Canadians are like Australians, but perhaps a little you're perhaps a little gentler. What is it about Canadians that makes them open and interested in pilgrimage?
Oh, wow. Good question. Now, I'm going to ask a question, then I'll answer your question. If you and I were on the Camino right now, walking and talking, where would we be? What section? Where would you like to be walking and talking?
Oh, I know exactly where I'd like to be. Walking between Tricastella and Samos.
Okay, we're there.
Right? Through the tunnel of the canopy.
Okay, gotcha. Why do Canadians, are they attracted to pilgrimage? That's a really good question. I think Canadians in general are attracted to adventure. We do have that quality in us. It's probably built into the spirit of, moving across the country over 500 years. Geez, that's a really profound question. What is it in our hearts that goes on journey? Well, I think journey is a part of our heart, regardless of being Canadian or just somebody on the planet. Our heart is wired for journey and adventure. And I think that's what it is. And the Canadian, probably the space of the land, a lot of space, a lot of openness. A lot of different variations with the land, mountains, plains, prairies, a lot of lakes. So we are privy to a lot of really special, special outdoor, venues to go and play and learn in. So I know for me, I mean, I spent a lot of time in Northern Ontario canoeing, paddling, hiking. So that call is... deeply, deeply rooted in most of us.
What about you, Brad? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
What about me? Okay. I'm 63 years old right now. I'm a writer, author, poet. I've worked in the environmental movement as well over the years. I tend to lead a pretty kind of quiet, simple life. I really spend my time writing and playing with words on the page. That's my real passion, other than, talking about the Camino.
So what was it about the Camino that appealed to you?
Well, I first stumbled on it when I was 27, 28, 20, between 27 and 28. I really didn't know anything about it until I read a book review in a Toronto newspaper. I was living in Toronto at the time. I just read a book review about a book called The Hug for the Apostle by Laurie Dennett. And she's a Canadian woman, Toronto, and she had done the walk in, I think, probably 84, 85, and published a great book in 86. And I just saw the book review, and I was just a couple of paragraphs in, and I knew this was something I wanted to do. I just said, okay, I'm gonna do that walk. I didn't know when I would do it. It took me another 2 years to get at it. But it just kind of hooked my heart and my feet and my soul. It had to do with the feeling of the history of it, being in Europe, the religious spiritual aspect of it, even though I was sort of unaware of the depth of it there. But I had been in Europe earlier, and I'd been hiking around France in 1983 on the GR65, which is actually the Camino, but I didn't know that then. So I was in the Le Puy route, kind of hiking around there, and I kept bumping into the markers and the signs for the French GR65, which was just a hiking route, but it had the Camino history in it. But at that point, that wasn't marked as the Camino, so I really didn't know about it. But I was attracted to it primarily for the landscape. I knew the landscape in that area of France was really delicious.
Yeah,
it was really sensuous. And once I saw the article that she walked through France and then into Spain and knowing that territory, I said, yeah, well, I didn't. Now I'm going to walk that because now I can. Now there's sort of a deeper reason to walk it. And there's actually this crazy trail, winds over to the west coast of Spain. So I just said, okay, I'm going to walk that. And I waited 2 years to get on it. And of course, you know, there's the inner Camino, you know, there's the inner Camino in us all, in our hearts and souls that perhaps when it sees the outer Camino, hears about it, the two enter a relationship, you know, the inner and the outer enter a relationship, go, okay, let's get that inner walking with the outer. Because I'd been on a journey, you know, through my 20s, sparked by the death of a friend when I was 19 years old. He was a really close best friend and brother. And that death, you know, introduced me to a world of tragedy and grief, unlike I'd known up and, you know, I hadn't really known that at all at that age. But that set me off on this path that I didn't know existed.
Yeah.
And I wasn't raised in any denomination. I was part of a Judeo-Christian background, but I wasn't raised in any particular denomination. But I found myself being attracted towards Catholicism, and I started doing religious studies in university and kind of going down the healthy rabbit hole of mysticism and meditation and contemplation, and that road. And especially through the writings of Thomas Merton and Thomas Keating and then Meister Eckhart, that road kind of, you know, wraps up by seeing that book review and then going, yes, 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 yes.
Wow. I mentioned in the introduction that on the Camino, you'll find yourself whiling away the afternoon talking to a stranger who in time may become a friend. But what is it about the Camino, Brad, do you think, that lends itself to us opening up to others, to sharing our stories with people we've just met?
Huh, good question. Yeah, so you and I are walking from Triacosti into San Luis. Yeah, I know, because I've done it 8 times. You know, we come across on the Camino, we come across reality, capital R, reality. We enter the sacred space of reality, and we are away from all the world of forms and names, you know, that we get wrapped up in life, the concrete, the cars, the way we muscle through the world, you know, with our great technologies. On the Camino, that's gone. And there's capital R, sacred reality, right in our face. It's like we're face to face with the God that we are not supposed to say the name of, like it says in the Old Testament. So what's that reality? That reality, you know, utter vulnerability, utter complexity, utter intimacy, and beauty and terror, the whole thing's there. And so when we come across a Dan or a Brad or a, or whoever, we kind of enter a walking relationship, and walking has got that beautiful rhythm to it that, you know, step by step, breath by breath, and it really kind of fine tunes us and gets into us a nice alignment with the, let's say, with the universe and the earth, sky, clouds, one another, heart to heart, ear to ear, voice to voice. and vulnerability to vulnerability. And it's safe. It's safe. It's sacred safe. And that lends itself to stories. And then we open up.
Yeah.
Wow. And then great. We start playing music. We start playing music together. Yeah. Right. We start singing together. Yeah. I think that's part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned the eight Caminos. Have you always walked the same path, or have you done lots of different ones? Or
I've always done the Frances. I've always been attracted to that, primarily because all the other routes, they started popping up probably after 2005, maybe a few were sort of around, but the only one I really knew about was the Frances. I mean, in 89, that's all I knew about. 93, 95, 97, 2000. The Portuguese I started hearing about in 2009. Actually, in 2009, when I walked, I met a young woman who was also walking the Frances, and she was Portuguese, and she was telling me about how she was a part of a group opening up the Portuguese route. So that's when I started hearing, okay, there's other routes. I think the Norte was probably around in the early 2000s. But if I go by my credential, you know, on the back of the credential, it's got the routes on it.
Yeah.
Well, my early credentials only had the Frances on it. And now, you know, on the back of the credential, all the routes are on it. So I guess we could probably go back to the credentials and see if we can find when the other routes started cropping up. But yes, I've always done the Frances, and I don't mind that that's what I've done. I love the experience of seeing its evolution over the last 30 years. Yeah. I mean, it's changed, quite dramatically. The walk hasn't, the walk is still a walk. You still got to walk. You still got to sweat. You still got to deal with blisters. You still got to deal with the elements. But in terms of the amount of people, I mean, there's like just tons of people now. You know, 1989 and 93 and even 95, I'm going to say between, and I always did it in the summer, so, you know, top season, so to speak. But I'm gonna guess, you know, maybe there was kind of 20 to 30 to 40 people per section, you know, on the Camino, and then up ahead, the other 20 and behind. If that, I mean, most villages didn't even have albergues. Then they were actually called refugios back then. And a refugio might just be a little house with a couple of rooms and a couple of beds and maybe a shower, sometimes a kitchen facility. But back to the people. But now, you know, there's like, I don't know, 200, 300 people at peak season between villages as they go.
Yeah.
So that has really changed, and that also that leads to more infrastructure. So 89, 93, 95, it didn't change that much in those 6 years. Each time I went back, it was pretty much still the same albergue, the same refugio in the same towns, maybe one little new one. But usually it was just one place per town. And a lot of the sort of middle towns, especially on the Meseta, you know, a lot of the places you go through didn't have anything. So Otantis didn't have anything. Hornelios didn't have anything. Official, you know, I think 89 in Hornelios, I slept on the church porch there, with some friends in a tent and a sleeping bag. We just pitched it there. But now there's the municipal there. So the infrastructure has really changed over the 30 years. Now, of course, it's marked much better. It wasn't marked as well. The Yellow Arrows had started in 89. I think they probably started in 83, the story is. But I don't remember a lot of them. You know, it was kind of seat of your pants back then, which was beautiful. I mean, you didn't know what was ahead, you know, which is the way it should be the first time. And obviously it is the first time. The biggest evolution is the amount of people, the attraction now. I'm going to say sort of the hunger in our world now for these kind of journeys.
Yeah.
These kind of journeys. And there's something, as you know, extraordinarily unique about the Camino. I haven't been able to put my finger on it. I know it has something to do with what I was speaking about earlier, vulnerability and stuff, and also the deep, deep, deep communion that is established, the communion amongst strangers coming together, the communion of sharing meals together, of taking care of each other, of tending to the blisters of each other, wondering where each other are, you know, waking people up, making sure they're getting the sleep, making sure they're hydrated. The deep care that happens there is it's quite unlike anything else I've done journey-wise in the world. And I think it's because it's got that 1,200 year history.
Yeah.
That has survived wars and plagues and kings and queens and revolutions, and that thing has stayed there.
Right?
You know, yeah. It has stayed there, and it's being knit by the fabric of humanity, constantly walking it and injecting their sacred energy into it, you know, speaking from the sacred, through the sacred, as the sacred. And so this beautiful community flowers along the Camino in a way that, well, it'd be great if it did that everywhere. And it probably does, but we're probably less aware of it than we are there. We kind of loosen up there, you know, that's like the camera where we focus in to take one picture, but now we focus back and open that aperture, and we're on the, you know, the wide open meseta.
Yeah, yeah, how wonderful. I remember a pilgrim telling me once that the most amazing thing about the Camino is it gives you another perspective. He says that he kind of looks at things differently now. It's true, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, big time. Yeah, for sure. I mean, my eyes now are just always Camino eyes, in the sense I've never stopped walking the Camino since that first time. I also realized when I finished the first time that I'd always been walking the Camino. You know, it didn't just start when I was 19 with my friend's death and then off I go. It starts with the first step.
Yeah.
But I've been walking it ever since. Yes, the eyes are changed. The heart rate is changed. How we breathe is changed. How we speak is changed quite profoundly.
So how do you describe the Camino to people who ask about it?
Wow. I know I use the words that I used early: vulnerability, intimacy, complexity,
yeah,
uncertainty. I use those words, and I use those words deliberately, because I know from experience that quite often those are words that we struggle with. Well, we don't struggle with the words, we struggle with the experience. But I present in such a way to assure somebody that, you know, you'll get that there. And especially if it's somebody that's saying, you know, that's saying to me, oh, my life's so busy and I'm so stressed out and I'm so burnt out. And, well, you know, there's this beautiful thing over there in Spain, France. You can just go for a walk, you know. And I have to be honest, I don't know how many people I've spoken to have actually taken that task up. But I can tell one story. I mean, I was watching your lovely interview with Lee, and you're talking about, you know, the your song and how it's moved around and people are influenced by it. And, you know, I wrote a novel back in the 90s called Journey Mine. It was published in 2001. And there's this, it's actually about a young man traveling around the world, spreading his father's ashes. And, as he travels, he actually spends some time in Sydney there, Dan. And yeah, so he travels around the world. He goes to New Zealand, he goes to Australia, he goes to Singapore, and he goes to Europe, and he ends up walking on the Camino, and the book ends at Finisterre. So I wrote this book in the 90s. It came out in 2001. And in 2018, the last Camino I did, I was walking one day, towards the end, going into Arthua, And there's this man ahead of me walking along. He was kind of walking slowly. He was a little heavy backpack and a little heavy, slow stride. But I saw a little Canadian flag. So I kind of ambled up beside him and said hello. And he said hello. And we started chatting as pilgrims do, as you and I are doing it right now, in Tria Castilla de Samos. And he asked me what I did and stuff. And I said I was a writer. And I mentioned, I started. Well, I was telling stories first about the first Camino I did in 89 and stuff. And then he didn't know I was a writer. Then he said he recognized some of the stories. And he said to me, did you write a book? And I went, yeah. He goes, I heard you give a radio interview a couple of years ago, more than a couple of years ago, back when the book came out in 2001. And I went, yeah, that was me. And he goes, I'm here because of that book and you.
Wow.
And I started to tear up, actually, right? Because the book didn't sell like hotcakes. It wasn't a big bestseller or an Oprah book or anything. But it found this one guy. And this one guy found the Camino. And this one guy and I found each other. And he tells me this really sweet story of connectivity, unexpected. So... Yeah. I don't know where I was going with that.
That's amazing. That's fantastic, isn't it? Yeah.
I mean, what are the chances? What are the chances?
Yeah. What a blessing.
What a blessing indeed. Yeah. So that's kind of what I tell people about the Camino. And I'm very infectious about the Camino. And all my friends are, they're exposed to my infectiousness around the Camino. They know how much I love it. I have had a few friends join me from time to time, never to do the whole thing, but little parts of it. So that's been sweet that they come over. One of my friends came in 2009. He was just coming for 2.5 weeks. It was for my 50th birthday, and it was really sweet. My best friend, and he had to have his appendix out in Burgos. It blew up in Belorado, and so we had to take him to Burgos, and he was in the hospital for a week, and then he went home. but he did join me, and he put in the effort, and it was very sweet and beautiful.
What do you think the Camino is trying to tell us?
Whew. Slow down. Slow down, my man, my woman, my friend, my brother, my sister.
Yeah.
Get still. Breathe the silence. Just breathe that silence. Yeah. So something along those lines.
Yeah. What did you learn about yourself on the Camino?
Well, each one's been a little different, and I've done it at different, well, obviously at different ages, because that's sort of natural.
Yeah.
But as a young 30-year-old, the first time, I'll stick with the first time, 30. I was already pretty patient, but probably more patience. And I'll go back to the word slowing down. I have a mantra. I have a few mantras, but I have one mantra: go slow, be gentle, no shame. So, yeah, go slow, be gentle.
Yeah.
I learned that about myself. And I learned about simplicity. You don't need a lot. You don't need a lot to get by.
Yeah.
For sure. And I think a lot of people learn that there. I didn't have a lot to begin with, so it wasn't too easy to pare down. But I also, here's the big thing I learned about hospitality.
Huh.
Hospitality. Yeah, that's a big one. Hospitality is huge, because you're, and especially in 89, because the hospitality was so erratic, because each village, some villages had great places to stay and a lot didn't. So hospitality, how you're welcomed into somebody's home, or not, but the importance, you know, so when you are welcomed with open arms, it, especially on the Camino back then, it stands out. You remember it, you know, you give thanks. And when you're not, you know, you sort of remember it too. I do have a sweet story.
Yeah, sure.
Because it's around hospitality that just came to me now. So this would be 89, and I was with probably a group of about 20 people at this point. It was July the 25th, so it was Santiago's feast day, and it was very hot in the middle of July in Spain, as you know, on the Meseta. And we had come from Carrion de la Corns to Calzada de la Cueva.
Uh-huh.
And that's a good long stretch, 14, 15K of not much.
Yeah.
And we came into Calzada de la Cueva, and we were going to stay there. We had planned to stay there, and we planned to have a feast for Santiago's feast day. And it was also one of our companions' birthdays that day. So we arrived in town around 11:30, 12 o'clock. We looked around for the Albergue Refugio. We couldn't find it. And we asked a young man, if you know where it was, and he talked to his mother and somebody else. And then he took us back just down the street a little bit, and he pointed us to this building and this little house. And we kind of looked at it, and we looked at him, and we looked at it, because the door was broken, the windows were broken glass. Inside there was nothing but dirt and broken glass on the floor. There was just a little sink in a bathroom with a little bit of dripping water. There was kind of a stove. I mean, it was a beaten up place. And we kind of looked at him, and he looked at us, and we said, this is the Refugio. And he kind of said, yeah, see. And clearly the message was, don't stay here, you know, yeah, keep going. And we said, well, guess what? We're going to stay here. So we went in, and we went to the only store. We bought some cleaning stuff. We cleaned that sucker up. We cleaned that place up. We cooked up a big fiesta. We put up a sheet and tent in the backyard to cover us from the sun. And we had a proper fiesta, great meal. While we were doing all this preparation, the young man and a couple of other kids and a couple of parents, they came down and sat on a bench across the street watching us. They thought we were crazy, that we were fixing this broken place up. And we were doing it with joy. And then we were singing songs, because some of us had guitars and stuff. You would have loved it. You would have been,
yeah,
you would have been grooving and jiving and having a lifetime. And so they were watching us. As they were watching us, it came to me and one of my friends. We said, we should do a play tonight. We should do some theater for this town. And he said, well, what's the play going to be? And I said, the play is going to be about two pilgrims walking the Camino, and it's going to show all the different kinds of hospitalities they receive. And so you go to one village, you get some good hospitality, or another village, you get some poor, you know, on and on. The key is you show the exact same gratitude for each of the hospitalities, whether it's poor, good, bad, mediocre, in between. So we put this play together, and we went out at about 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night as the sun was going down, and it was still pretty hot. And we went through the town like troubadours, singing and, you know, calling people to come out of your homes into the center of the town and come on down. We're going to put on a play for you. And the parents were allowing the kids to come out to the center square. They were very suspect. Like, what are these pilgrims doing? They're not even supposed to be here. You know, get out of here. So we did the play. I was one of the pilgrims, and my buddy John was one of the pilgrims too. And it was all mimed. You know, we did mime, except we had somebody sort of narrating. And we did the play. We showed, you know, the different kinds of hospitality, and our gratitude was exactly the same no matter what we received, whether we slept on a bed of glass or a beautiful bed with great sheets and mattresses and so forth.
Yeah.
So we did the play. It was a great hit. I'm going to say, 4 years later, 1993, when I'm back on the Camino for the second time, I come to that village and I remember the village. In my head, I'm thinking, well, I'm not going to stay here. And I walk down, and that place, that exact place, was an albergue. All cleaned up, showers, furniture, beds, no broken windows, no broken doors. And it's still an albergue now. It's been sort of, I was in 2018, they've changed the door. It's sort of at the front. It's at a different place now, but it's still the same building. I didn't stay at that one. I stayed at the one next door. But yeah, so I'm not saying it was the play that made them clean it up. Yeah, but that was kind of the Camino back then. A lot of spontaneous, you know, sort of uproarious stuff can happen.
Wow, what a great story! Hey, what do you find most difficult or challenging on the Camino?
For me,
yeah.
I think, honestly, I don't really find anything challenging about it. I mean, sure, there's moments. Sometimes the wind, wind's in your...
Yeah.
I would say physically it can be the winds, but then you just sort of learn to lean into it and move with it. Obviously, some emotional stuff can come up, but what's the most challenging? Yeah, I don't really have an answer for that because I just found it so bloody wondrous. I'm just so in love with it. And I'm not saying that I haven't dealt with stuff while I'm on it, but now it seems so small to having finished it eight times at different stages of my life. Sometimes it is sure a challenge to be with your thoughts, but I think I was aided. I had developed a meditation practice in my early 20s. I just happened to meet a professor at university, introduced me to a monk that introduced me to a Christian centering prayer, and that kind of took off. So I had a foundation, an inner science foundation, so to speak, to lean on. So I had learned, I'd learned to distinguish between what are my thoughts and what are not my thoughts. And so on the Camino, I really just sort of get into a walking rhythmic meditation.
Yeah.
And stay with that and kind of cultivate that. So there's a really purposeful cultivation of that and allowing what arises in your mind to arise and not necessarily attach to it. Only look at it for what it needs to be looked at for and learn from it and keep stepping along. So the challenges are a little smaller that way, I think.
Yeah.
For me, they were. Yeah,
there's a great sense of satisfaction at the end of the day. You've overcome that day, the challenge of the Camino. It's not always a smooth journey, and it pretty much is the story of our lives, too.
It
can be very much a reflection of our daily lives. Do you draw on the strengths and lessons from the Camino often in your daily life?
All the time. I'm always on the Camino. I mean, even from a funny practical way, whenever I go into an outdoor store, I'm looking at the new tech gear and I'm looking at clothing going, that would be good. Oh, socks. Oh, those are perfect. Oh, hey, look, this is 10 ounces lighter. so just on that practical level, yes, for sure. But on an emotional, spiritual level, I'm on the Camino all the time. So I even have a walk here in Kingston that I call the Little Camino because I stop in the cathedral on the way back and I do an 8K walk every day. And the cathedral has a small chapel attached to it, which is called St. James, the chapel. And it's got a little pilgrim guy in the window. So I feel like I've had my little Camino here. And some of my friends here know about my little Camino. And they even ask me, can I go for a walk with you on your little Camino? So we go for a walk in the little Camino. So I'm walking every day. I'm living the Camino life every day from a position of gratitude, even hospitality, wonder.
Tell us about arriving in Santiago. What's so special about that day?
Oh, well, I've had different arrivals. The first one was quite special, just because it's the first one, and you know, and it's unknown. You don't, you know, I didn't know what it looked like. I was telling Lee actually that back then when you arrived in Monte Gozo, and you came up the hill there back in '89, the eucalyptus trees weren't on the right hand side. Because now those trees are so tall, when you get up the Monte Gozo, you can't see the city. You have to walk way out to the left to put those statues in. So back in '89, that was just a green hill. There was no the monument to the Pope in St. Francis wasn't there. The Albergue at the bottom of the hill wasn't there. That road wasn't a road. It was just gravel. The trees weren't there. So, and this is the way it was written about in the Middle Age, you know, literature. So you walk up and you saw the three spiraling towers of the cathedral. And that's how you knew you were there. You had 5K to go, 5 kilometers to go to this thing you've been walking towards. For me, the first time I walked from France, I'd done 1,400 kilometers or something. So 3 months of walking. So you see it, it's pure elation. And also back then, the tradition was that you walked the last 5 kilometers from Monte Gozo into the city barefoot. So I took my boots off. We all took our boots off, and we walked barefoot down the gravel road, and then to Santiago. And as you know, when you get into the old city, once you get down to the bottom there, you can't see the cathedral anymore.
Yeah,
and you wind through the streets, and then you come down the Via Sacra, I guess it is, and then suddenly there it is on your side, and you look up. Oh wow, there it is! But you got to find the front door now, and then you go through the tunnel, and there's a guy there with the bagpipes. And you come around, and so that first time was, you know, pure elation. That the feeling of all those kilometers in my feet, in my body, in my heart, in my soul, just welling up. We stood out front for a while, kind of basking in it, but we really wanted to go in. And back then, you could go in with your backpack. There wasn't any of this leave your backpack outside thing. And so we walked in with our backpacks and our bare feet, you know, all sweaty, you know, very, very hippie looking probably. and also back then, the column inside the door that you know, with the holes where you put your hand and then bow your head, that was, you were allowed to touch it back then. Now you can't. So we got to do that ritual. And so you really feel this really elegant, beautiful sense of completion, that you've been moving toward. You know, there's a saying that first the journey to God, then the journey in God. So there's a feeling like you've been journeying to God to get to the cathedral, and now you're in the cathedral. Now it's the journey in God. Now you sit in the sacred space in God, you know, as St. Paul says, in whom we live and move and have our being. So now you're sinking in to the beauty of the cathedral. And that time, we arrived for pilgrim mass. So pilgrim mass is beginning. Then they swang the Boat of Fumato. So the incense is flooding the, you know, all of us. And it wasn't too full because there wasn't a lot of pilgrims back then. And then mass began. So, and they read out our names back then as well. And your starting point. So there's a real sense of understated accomplishment, because that's the way I say it, because it's not like climbing Everest, but maybe it's like climbing the Everest of your heart, you know.
Maybe
it's like that.
Yeah.
The other times were a little different because I knew kind of what to expect, but they were all still maybe the other times I probably stayed outside longer because I knew I was inside. So I probably stayed outside longer and kind of basked and took it in. And of course, now over the years, it's busier now. So there's more people in the square, and the arrival has this, you're seeing tons of celebrations of people that you haven't, other pilgrims who you haven't met, but you're seeing the same energy. You're seeing the same glint in their eyes that you have with your group, right?
Yeah.
The same sharings. And they're probably telling the same stories.
Yeah. Right?
You know? So, yeah, it's a great sense of celebration.
What advice would you give someone thinking of doing the Camino?
Other than saying go, I would say go. I would say, well, it's hard, eh? You don't want to go with expectations. Expectations can get in the way. I've seen that happen with some pilgrims where they've come with expectations and then they're let down. And then telling somebody don't have expectations, you know, that's a bit of an art.
Right? Yeah.
Not to have the expectations. I would say just go and allow yourself just to breathe. Just to be, because in a sense, just to be with our being, just to be is like the highest form of prayer. We're so, you know, caught up in time as a production, you know, as a means to something, as opposed to time out of time as ritual. So I would say, go there and breathe. Go there and breathe, and I might add, and be surprised.
Oh wow, that's great advice. I've thoroughly enjoyed talking to you, Brad. It's been a real delight. I'm going to finish by quoting Gord Downie. He said once, "I'm interested in doing anything that teaches me something."
Wow.
Isn't that just about the perfect quote?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
I'm interested in doing anything that teaches me something.
Yeah, you always want to learn. Yeah, you always
want to learn. And we've certainly learned a lot via your wisdom and insight in this conversation.
Oh, thank you.
The Camino teaches us plenty, I find. And it's not just on the path, but on the shared journey that we all collectively undertake and continue to walk together in conversations like these. So, Brad, thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan. I really appreciate it. It's a great gift.
Yeah.
Great gift.
Walk on, pilgrim, and buen camino.
Buen camino, you walk on too, brother.
My guest this week was Brad Batten, a Canadian pilgrim who walked 8 Caminos. Anthony Bourdain said of Spain in his off-the-cuff TV series, "Any reasonable sentient person who looks at Spain, comes to Spain, eats in Spain, drinks in Spain, they're going to fall in love. Otherwise, there's something deeply wrong with you." Isn't that great? And the great Canadian musician and lead singer of the band, the tragically hip Gord Downie, said, "I'm interested in doing anything that teaches me something." I love that. And very special thank you to Julie, who joined me as a sponsor this week via Patreon. I really appreciate it, Julie. You can join me as a sponsor as well, if you like, patreon.com/Dan Mullins, helping to keep the podcast going. Thanks for your company this week and every week. Until next week, I'm Dan Mullins. Buen Camino. Somewhere